studio. He's the owner and founder of Celestial Events. And I did mention to you the exciting opportunities that he can bring to you, to your lodge, to your individual homes, and what you can learn about. But we've got the specialist in studio, and we are going to be welcoming him here. Welcome, Ben. Lovely to have you in studio.
Thank you very much. And then, it's an honor to be here.
It's always a pleasure. I've got the hoodlum behaving himself in the corner. And I have got a little electric prod. And if he misbehaves, I shall use it. But Ben, welcome again. Ben, as I do with everyone that I interview, just a little synopsis of where you come from. Where did you go to school? The interest, studying, and then obviously, how do you land up here in Hoedspruit?
Okay, well, my story may be a little different from others. You can probably tell from the accent, I can't hide from it, that I wasn't born and raised in South Africa. I am English by descent. I was born and educated towards the south coast of England, but I always harboured a fascination and a love, particularly of African wildlife and topography and everything that goes with it. It was a bucket list to go on safari. And a long story short, the opportunity finally arose when I was in my early 20s to come and experience South Africa. And it was a sort of a go big or go home moment. So I threw everything I had and enrolled in Bushwise Field Guides, which at the time I was on their very first course that they ever did. So I came over in 2006-2007, and I did their 1 year field guide course, did 6 months of training, 6 months of practical placement, and basically never went home. So this is my 19th year now of being in South Africa, so this is very much my second home. But yeah, born, raised, educated in England, but have made between Nelspruit and Hoedspruit my home for the last nearly 20 years.
So this is where the roots are, hey?
Yes, the roots have spread across the equator and come south. Yeah.
And what got you interested in astronomism?
People often ask me that, and it's such a difficult question to answer. I think the simplest answer is that I'm a big kid that never grew up. I always sort of say to people that I think when we are kids, most kids are infatuated with the night sky, spaceships and rockets to Mars and aliens and sci-fi movies. And then most of us grow up and do real life things. And I never did, to be quite honest. I just find the whole thing, you sort of touched on it before, it's a really interesting mixture of being absolutely fascinating and thought-provoking and imagination-stimulating. Mm. And incredibly relaxing, and sort of to find that solace in this busy, fast-paced world where you can have every answer at the touch of a button these days. It's beautiful to be able to stare up into a dark abyss and wonder.
Absolutely. I was saying earlier on, my girlfriends and I, we used to have a trampoline at home, and we used to sneak out. Not that we would smoke or do anything like that.
Of course not.
And we would go lie on the trampoline, and it was pitch black, and it was just that looking up and you're letting your imagination go wild and creating pictures and creating animals, and that's just what it's all about, letting your imagination run wild.
And I think that's the key word, the imagination, because the world that we live in, yes, technology has done wonderful things for us, but it has destroyed our ability or need to imagine, because we can find the answer to everything, but there's a lot of mystery up there, and I think there's something that draws all of us towards that unknown, and it's a powerful experience for
absolutely,
many.
Absolutely, absolutely. And but tell me, Ben, what is Celestial Events SA, and how did you come about creating this business?
Well, it was sort of a byproduct, really, of my career within the safari industry. So for the first 10 years of my career here, I guided at a variety of lodges in this area down in KwaZulu-Natal. I spent some time in Tanzania doing these sort of classic lodge guiding, and it was something that I always tried to include in the evening safari with some stargazing, because it was an interest of mine that did start when I was back in England. Not that there were many clear nights, I should point out.
A few.
Yes, one or two a year. And then, of course, I had to learn everything upside down, yeah. for all the right way up for you guys, of course. So that I started to do that. And then from there, I moved into to the training aspect. So I did 5 or 6 years of guide training at both Eco Training and Bushwise. And again, I was very passionate about that. And it became pretty apparent to me that whilst astronomy is a an aspect of the guide training, that not a great deal of emphasis is put on it, and the training that is given, very few guides either want to, or probably more to the point, are confident and comfortable enough to actually incorporate it into the safari experience. So that was something that I wanted to change. I started to make a big deal out of it, and it sort of, the natural progression was I would do evenings with my guests. Other guys would ask if their guests could join me because yes. they knew I enjoyed doing it. And then the lodge would ask me to do evenings for all of the guests. And then, yeah, sort of moving down the line, it culminated in, was it about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I wrote a syllabus for Fagasa as a standalone astronomy qualification, which is now up and running. And many people, I'm very proud to say, have done and attained that qualification, and the interest was such that probably about 4 years ago I left full-time employment, and now run celestial events on a full-time basis, where I offer a variety of different services to the tourism and the lodge industry.
Okay, so that's the service industry there. And there's obviously a huge calling for it, you know. I think, you know, you've got your bird lovers, you've got your big five lovers, you've got your plant lovers, and why not incorporate stars, hey?
Well, we're so lucky here. In game reserves are, by definition, generally speaking, at least in fairly remote areas, yes. with a minimum of light pollution. It's a great way to connect with nature in general, utilizing the stars and the dark skies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just something that I think so many people are interested in. And I certainly noticed that when I started doing these evenings, I had so much interest and positive comments that it's something that not enough fuss is made of. About.
It's such a missed opportunity, in my opinion. I mean, I'm one of those frustrated stargazers because I just don't have the ability to recall, you know, to retain yeah. a lot of the information, you know, which I think happens if you go once in a while with yeah. somebody, you know, you need to sort of become more practiced at it.
But that's the thing. I think so many people are interested in it, but I think a lot of people shy away from it because they're intimidated, because it's science and space and it's so yeah. big. So you do need somebody who, for want of a better phrase, is sort of going to hold your hand through it and explain sure. things yeah. in relatable terms. From a guide training aspect, that's something I put a lot of focus on, that, you know, things are far away, things are big, but how far and how big, and how can you make that relatable for the layperson to understand? I think that's very important.
And so with that in mind, would your talks cover the difference between a planet and a star and a you know, I guess a galaxy and Earth.
I mean, it very much depends. It's such a vast topic. Yeah, actually, one of the hardest things is to choose what to focus on.
Sure.
So if I'm doing a presentation to the public, for example, I'll generally try and give quite a generic overview. Well, we'll start with the basics. I have my particular areas of interest that I like to focus on. But my ethos has always been very much to not go too deep into the yeah. science. I'm not an astrophysicist. I don't have a white coat and big yeah. bushy beard and glasses, and to be incredibly stereotypical about it. I don't understand quantum physics and all of that yeah. stuff. But what I think is important is to take the main principles of the science and say break it down into understandable parts that people can relate to. So be it, how is a star formed? What is the difference between a star and a planet? Some of the history behind it. And a particular interest of mine is the cultural aspect of it, the star lore and the mythology.
Okay.
That sounds wonderful. And amazing. Obviously covering star clusters, distance nebula and galaxies, and the moon and planets.
That's yeah, so a little bit of everything, really. So, as I said, it's such a vast topic yeah. that it's very difficult to know. But people don't want to be drowned in information guiding and any form of presentation and education is about storytelling ultimately. So it's being able to tell a succinct, accurate story in a relatable manner is very important. So trying to cover as much as possible. So the moon is such a prominent feature, and there are so many beautiful stories about it, and it is within reach to anybody with a pair of binoculars.
I was just going to ask you there, do you need a telescope to enjoy astronomy?
No, not in the slightest. I own a couple of different telescopes, but I get just as much, if not more, enjoyment, as you said, about just sort of lying on a blanket under the stars, even just doing naked eye viewing on a dark, clear night, yeah. Or a simple pair of binoculars. And I think a lot of people do think, oh, we must have to have a telescope.
Yes, yes.
You don't. I don't use the telescope as much as I could do, yeah. and I would say it probably only forms about probably less than half of a typical, what I call a night sky safari. The majority of it is showing people the constellations, telling them the stories behind them, identifying the shapes, the major stars that people will have heard of. And the telescope is the wow factor.
Yes, of course.
The surface of the moon is amazing. The planets are beautiful to see. And there are some lovely hidden objects out there. But it is by no means a requirement to enjoy it.
You know, what has been quite topical now is the alignment of the planets, which is, you know, something that happens so infrequently. It's every 30 years or something, isn't it?
I couldn't give you the exact figure. Say the planets are always in a line. You're always going to find the planets somewhere along the ecliptic, so the zodiac signs. So if you want to find any of the planets, it's going to be in one of those 12 zodiac signs. So at the moment, Mars you can clearly see in Gemini, Jupiter is in Taurus, the other visible planets are now below the horizon.
Really?
They've been and gone. That alignment was a couple of weeks ago. But they're always in a line across the sky, but yeah. It just depends where they are and where we are on our orbits around the sun as to whether we can see them all during darkness, basically.
But you can't see all of them with the naked eye, surely?
No. I shall call it Uranus to avoid giggling, but Uranus and Neptune are not really visible. Uranus is on the cusp of naked eye visibility, if you know where to look. But to be honest, even through a telescope, those two are so far away that they just look like small sort of bluish coloured stars. Mm. So those two, it's great to be able to say you've seen them.
Yeah.
But the real stars of the show, wrong choice of word, the real planets of the show are Jupiter and Saturn, where you can see some nice detail. You can see the rings, you can see the cloud bands, because they are so large.
And I believe Saturn's rings are not visible at the moment, are they?
No, as of pretty much now, the rings have disappeared. Don't worry, they are still there. It's just the orientation at which we're viewing them. We're looking at them completely side on. And the rings themselves are incredibly thin, on average only about 100 meters thick, which is amazing to think you're looking at something that's 1.5 billion kilometers away, and you can see that feature that is so thin. But therefore, when the plane is directly pointed at us, then they have disappeared. It doesn't affect us because we can't see it now. It's below the horizon after dark.
Yeah.
But in other areas, Saturn will just look like a ball at the moment, and the rings will slowly start to come back over the coming months.
And there's obviously the better and bestest places to go and do stargazing. Where in South Africa would you say is the best place?
Well, there are so many. I mean, people talk about travelling to dark skies. I mean,
yes,
in a perfect world,
the
darker the better, the less light pollution, the better. That's assuming there's no moon, of course, because the moon is light pollution to some extent as well. But as I said, any game reserve, even here in Hoedspruit, it's a bustling metropolis that is growing, but we are still very fortunate here to have good dark skies.
Yes,
you just have to go into Kruger or into one of the private reserves, and you can see a huge amount. And I recently discovered that. I was fortunate enough to go to Dubai a few months ago training out in the desert with some guides in stargazing. And we were about 60, 70 kilometers away from central Dubai. And I can assure you that the skies here in Hoedspruit are darker.
That's great to know.
Such as the light glow from Dubai. So anywhere where there are not people, and South Africa has vast tracts of land without it. So anywhere in the Kruger Park, The Karoo obviously is a very well-known area, a mecca for stargazing and research grade telescopes that are down there. Mm. Go up into the Kalahari. Mm. So yeah, just go away from people.
The further away the better.
Yes, basically.
And just another question that I've put together here, so I hope it makes sense. How does the International Space Station and or Starlink satellites in space orbiting Earth influence or affect stargazing?
From a stargazing perspective, it doesn't really make a great deal of difference. They are too small and too far away to affect the clarity of the sky around them. Can we see them? Yes, you can. If you see a star moving across the sky, it's going to be a satellite, be it the Hubble, which you can also see with the naked eye of the space station. The majority are Starlink satellites. You'll see a lot of them early evening because the sun's rays are still sort of getting through to the top part of the sky and reflecting off those satellites. Remember, they don't produce their own light. They're just reflecting light. So it doesn't affect the viewing experience, and actually it's quite fun. We can get apps these days. There are many apps that you can use. A lot of them will give you to the second when these objects are passing. So you can wave to the astronauts on the space station.
So that's clearly why none of my wishes have come true.
You're wishing on the wrong star.
I've been wishing on these bloody
satellite.
And I'm waiting.
The biggest issue with the satellites doesn't really affect stargazing, but it does affect the research community and those of us who enjoy astrophotography.
Of course.
Because they leave these rather annoying white stripes across
all of
your images. So that is the biggest problem with them.
And just another question here for you, Ben. What is the government doing to augment astro-tourism in South Africa?
Well, that's a very good question and very topical at the moment. Just towards the end of last year, the government released their official astro-tourism strategy. Astro-tourism is the biggest growing trend within the tourism industry at the moment.
Amazing.
Apparently, I can't give you figures to back that up, but that is the general consensus. And many of the big sort of tour operators are telling us that they're having a big influx of people wanting to travel to dark sky areas and enjoy the sanctity of the night sky and the beauty of it and the connection to nature that comes with it. So South Africa, I'm very happy to say, has embraced that as well. And the strategy has just been released last year. It's going to take some time to come into effect, but there's a big push to preserve the sanctity of the dark skies, to build an astro-tourism community, job creation around that. And most importantly, as I'm sure we'll come on to, is to try and save and spread the indigenous cultural knowledge of ancient people and tribes that are sort of inscribed upon those constellations.
And for so long they were the center of tribal cultural the whole basis of their religion, basis of their faith.
Absolutely. It's a storyboard.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. They sat around the campfire and they made shapes in the sky, and they then sort of superimposed their cultural beliefs, their memories, their stories, their history on them. And the sad fact, and this is the same across the world, is that those stories are dying out because they were all oral tradition, and particularly down in these parts, they've never been documented. Most people know the Greek mythology because the Greeks were the first people to officially document it. But trust me, and I speak from experience, to try and find traditional African star lore from Bushman, from Zulu, from Xhosa, Venda, Tswana, it's so hard to find because it's not documented anywhere. And the best thing you can do is talk to people, and unless they tell people, those stories are gone in a generation, and that's very sad.
Gets lost home. What areas of astronomy are you most interested in, and why?
Well, particularly that side of it. I think there's an awful lot of, you can go to observatories and see planets and clusters and hear about the science behind them, which is interesting to many people. But I think one of the most important aspects for me is exactly, as I said, it's cultural stories. Yeah, and some of them are a bit far-fetched, certainly, but it doesn't matter because it's based on oral tradition, and that's the beauty of it. It's not bound by science. It's only bound by imagination, which back in those days was boundless.
Yeah.
And there are some beautiful stories.
Can you give me some examples?
I can, yes.
I'd love to hear.
Well, let's do a topical one. A very famous, probably the most famous constellation in the Southern Hemisphere is the Southern Cross, which you can see in the southeast after dark now. Very happy to see it back. It's had disappeared for a couple of months. So one story that I particularly like, if you can visualize the diamond shape of the cross, and just beneath it in this orientation is the two what we call the pointer stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri, which are very bright. They're the third and 11th brightest star in the sky. So there are stories that the Bushmen saw the four stars of the Southern Cross as a pride of lionesses. And as the lionesses roamed across their territory during the course of the night, as the Southern Cross moved, as the hours ticked by, they were being followed by the two pride males, the brighter two stars underneath, just the way that the males often do follow the females out here in the bush. So there are many examples of animals in the night sky, particularly from traditional African star lore, because of what they grew up with and their experiences.
Oh, that's phenomenal. It's lovely. You know, tradition and culture is something that's embedded. And it's always sad when we have the schools love to have a culture day, and there's so many kids that come to school and they don't know what their culture is. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's been wiped out over generations and generations. So you lose that, which is unfortunately sad. And but any tips for astrophotography?
I have many. That's a whole other show in itself. There are so many different varieties of photography. It's something that I'm very interested in. I started out doing wildlife photography as a guide, which is quite normal, but so many people do it. I got a little bit disgruntled with it because everybody always had the better picture. And you know what it's like, it's a never-ending
competition.
It feels like it. We should do it for ourselves, but we are all competitive.
Have you published a book at all?
No, just the manual, but I have plans.
Yes, good.
But I'm an excellent procrastinator, so we'll have to see in the future.
So we definitely need a coffee table stargazing.
I do have a plan, and it is to keep away from the science, and it would be, the idea is to collate all of those cultural stories, not just from Africa, but so we're going off topic here, but it's very interesting to me to see the similarities and the differences between different cultures, be they Aboriginal. I spent nearly a year in New Zealand a couple of years ago, so I learnt about Maori star lore.
Beautiful.
Got Mayan, Incan, Greek, Roman, Egyptian, North American tribes. There are so many.
Interesting crossovers.
Yeah, there are many things that were seen as same things and other things that were seen as completely different. And because they're so hard to come by, you can Google the science behind the stars anywhere. But, say, finding those stories in one place is very, very difficult. So that will be a project at some point. But back to your original question, tips for... we'll stick with sort of the general equipment, because you can get very specialized equipment for taking deep sky objects, which is something that I'm very passionate about, but does require relatively bespoke equipment. But anybody, especially with the way cameras are, even cell phone cameras these days, can take long exposure photography. In a perfect world, having a star tracker which follows the movement of the sky to allow you longer exposures. Remember, the more zoom you have, the more obvious the motion of the sky. But if you haven't got one of those, a simple tripod, a camera, put your ISO up quite high, have your widest aperture that you can, and then sort of a stalwart of astrophotography is, some people use the rule of 500. I'm a bit more picky and prefer the rule of 300. So whatever your focal length is that you're taking of your zoom is on your lens, divide that number into 300, and whatever the answer is going to be the maximum exposure that you should use before you'll get obvious movement. So to make it very simple, if you are shooting at 30 millimeters, divide that into 300, you get 10. So anything more than 10 second exposure, you're going to start seeing movement in your stars. So the more zoom you have, the shorter exposure you would need, and vice versa.
But you showed me that camera of yours, which is fascinating, because that actually follows the sky, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I've got a whole photographic telescopic rig, if you like. So I've got a star tracking, what we call an equatorial mount. So that's super accurate. I have to align it first, but that can take pictures at sort of, you know, 1,000 millimeters, I can take a 10-minute exposure with no motion in the sky.
But it's, because it obviously has to follow the sky.
Yeah.
So
Well, remember, the Earth is moving, not the sky.
Yeah, no, no, but, indeed, yeah. Indeed. But it's got to follow the, whatever your object is.
So I started out, as most astrophotographers do, with, I had a telescope, and then I had a DSLR camera, and you can get attachments that you put the camera on the back of the telescope, and you start out, and I found it just so mind-blowing to be able to photograph things that are potentially millions of light years away. I'm photographing photons of light that have been traveling for millions and millions of years, and then visualizing it on a, say, a page on a computer screen. That's showing my age, but that's amazing to me. And I've sort of slowly gone up the ladder of astrophotography, and now have a specialized telescope which is designed for photography. I have an astrophotographic camera which you can't look through. It's designed to go on the back of a telescope. It's very sensitive to low light. I use filters to isolate particular gases and things up in the night sky, and that is it's a labor of love.
Yeah.
People think I'm a bit mad because you can't just take a picture.
Yeah.
I normally gather somewhere between 4, maybe 8 hours worth of exposure on a single object, and then you edit that in its entirety to produce one picture.
Would you take that equipment with you when you are doing one of the when you are doing an event?
Yeah, so when I go and conduct,
people can have a look and see and
exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So if I'm doing a night sky safari, which I did one last night for a lodge in the Klisiri, I take both telescopes. So I've got a visual telescope that we look through, and then I also take the photographic telescope, because so such is the technology. It's all controlled through Wi-Fi, and it projects these live images. And 30 seconds is enough for a sort of show and tell. We're not creating magazine standard images, and that projects a live image onto a tablet or onto a screen. So it's a really nice contrast to look at something with the naked eye, look at something through the telescope, and then truly see what is hiding in the darkness with the more sensitive equipment.
And just another one, Ben. What are the sort of more important dates for stargazing? Any events that are coming up that you can share with us?
There are. It's obviously dependent upon sort of date and time as to where you're going to be and where you're going to look at. I did have a quick look. I did make a note of it. Excuse me. I'm just trying to find my notes. Sort of the big things have kind of already happened recently with the planetary alignment. And we had the comet last year that we were definitely able to see. In fact, there were two naked eye comets towards the end of last year. In terms of this year, so there's nothing sort of spectacular happening that we know of yet. But remember, a lot of these comets, for example, we only find out about them a few months before they become visible, because by definition, they might have never been here before, or their orbits might be thousands and thousands of years and they've never been documented before.
Sure.
So those can happen at any time. There are meteor showers throughout the year where we get an influx of shooting stars in the night sky at particular times. The best one of the year is always the first 2 weeks of August, the Perseid meteor shower.
That's the night I do the wishing.
Yes, that's the one where you go out there with all your wishes. You potentially might see tens, maybe even hundreds in the course of a night.
Lovely, I'll have a long list.
But you never know. Sometimes, some years it's good, some years it isn't. The moon phase will influence how much you can see. So first 2 weeks of August, the Perseid meteor shower. There was a lunar eclipse couple of days ago, but it wasn't visible from South Africa. But there will be another one on the 7th of September.
I saw the pictures from India. A friend of mine was in India. She had amazing pictures.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, a beautiful red hue, because that's
it's a blood moon, no?
Well, if it's a total lunar eclipse, it will always be red during the totality of the eclipse.
Okay.
That is due to the Earth having an atmosphere. So when the Earth blocks the light of the sun from hitting the moon, which is what an eclipse is, because we have an atmosphere, the rays of light are refracted through our atmosphere and projected onto the moon. So it's one way of looking at it. It's the same principle as sunrise and sunset. Yeah. We have very red skies that change colour as the sun gets higher. So basically, during a total lunar eclipse, all the Earth's sunrises and sunsets are being projected onto the face of the moon, which is why it turns red, which is a nice way of looking at it. But we should see that, weather depending, 7th of September. We mentioned Saturn earlier. On the 21st of September, Saturn will be at what we call opposition, which is when it's at its closest point to us. So that will be the best time to view it. It'll be biggest in the telescope.
But you still won't see the rings? Because you,
you will by then.
Will you? Okay.
They'll still be relatively shallow.
Shallow, okay.
It'll take a few years before it gets the tilt. Point where we can see the most of the rings, but you'll still be able to see the rings by September. Mm. And then in terms of sort of other exciting astronomical news, hopefully, and these things are always delayed, but theoretically at some point in the middle of the year, the big new observatory is going to be up and running in the States, what they call the Vera Rubin Observatory, which is going to again, I don't want to sort of get too deep into the science of it, but it's going to perform incredible surveys and allow us to see amazing things up in the sky using new technology, new photographic equipment. Hopefully we'll find Planet Nine. I think that's one of its goals. And a whole variety of other stuff. It's going to map huge areas of the sky every few days and look for things that are changing and try and understand what they are. So that will open a new era of astronomical observation.
I actually watched a documentary a couple of nights ago on the Webb Ellis telescope, and how that was sort of the evolution of extraterrestrial telescopes, basically from the Hubble, and what that enabled. It's amazing.
Yeah, what that thing can do, and the feat of technology to basically flat pack it, launch it up, it's sitting there a million miles away from Earth, whatever it is, and then it unfolded itself, and it sees in a different wavelength of light than Hubble, so it can see different things. Obviously, if you've got a space telescope that doesn't have to look through the atmosphere, you can see a lot more. This one I just mentioned, the Vera Rubin Observatory, is here on Earth, but it's taking wide-angle stuff, so it's not so important. But James Webb, seeing in infrared, which means it can see very, very distant things because of redshift. It can see through dust because those red wavelengths of light can penetrate the dust. But it has to be kept very cool, so it's got those big solar sails to block out the heat from the sun. Yeah. It's an incredible feat of engineering. It was very expensive and took a long time.
I can imagine.
But like with all of these space telescopes, by the time it went up there, it was already sort of 15 years old in terms of tech. So there are suggestions for new space telescopes in the future, but they take a long time.
Is that a more distant orbit to the Hubble?
Yeah, Hubble is only sort of about, I forget exactly, but a few hundred kilometers above our head. You can see it passing overhead. It's a LEO satellite, low Earth orbit satellite. So you can, just like you can see the space station, if you've got your app, it'll tell you when Hubble will be visible. You can see the white dot going across the sky. We can't see James Webb. It's really far away and not visible in the night sky.
Well, just a last question from my side. Make with it what you can. But let's just say man, human, are based on the Moon and Mars in, say, 10 years. Is it even possible? And what would they be able to observe that we couldn't from Earth?
Well, I think that's a question for Elon, if I'm honest. Look, whether we'll be on Mars in 10 years' time, I think it's highly unlikely. But there are plans to utilize the Moon more than we are doing. There's ideas of finding resources and minerals up on the Moon. One of some exciting opportunities that may or may not happen, but they are being discussed at least, is to have a telescope on the Moon, also to have a moon base from which we can launch rockets into space from the Moon instead of Earth, which would actually cut down on costs because the Moon has a lot less gravity, so you need a lot less fuel to escape from its gravity. Personally, I it's just a matter of time. I think if we can, there's no reason that we wouldn't have the technology. There's no reason that we can't get it up there if we can all work together to make it possible and have, more importantly, the funding to funnel into it. These are all possibilities. In terms of what we would see, the night sky is going to look basically identical whether you're on Mars, the Moon, Earth. So you've got to remember these stars are hundreds of light years away. So us moving a few hundred thousand kilometers makes no difference whatsoever. The shapes, the orientation of the stars might be slightly different just due to the angle, but
if you were on the surface of the moon, Orion is going to look like Orion. Same. It will just be a lot clearer because you haven't got to look through the atmosphere. Yeah. That's because the moon has no atmosphere. But it's a great opportunity, and it is the obvious next step of space travel, which may or may not lead to space tourism and everything that may or may not go with it. But time and finances and politics will tell.
Absolutely, and I think there's so much money involved in that industry.
James Webb in itself was, I think, $12 billion it cost from concepts to actually putting it in space. And there are many people who quite rightly argue maybe that money could have gone into something else more worthwhile. Yeah. But, you know, it has enabled us to understand our position in the galaxy and in the universe in far greater detail and maybe from a bigger picture. It's interesting, if nothing else.
And just to close off on the interview, what is your next event or your next job coming up? Is there something specific that you are going to be doing? You said you just got back from Dubai.
If all goes according to plan, weather-wise, which is not looking very hopeful, summer's a difficult time for me and what I do because of the weather conditions here. Yes, we love the rain, but it's not conducive to stargazing, although it is improving now. If all goes according to plan, I'm supposed to be in the Timbervati for 3 nights tomorrow to do some guide training and a guest event. But my big exciting news, which is not yet completely confirmed, but I think it's just a matter of time, as I shall be heading up to Tanzania next month to go and do some training up there. I'm very fortunate that there is a big interest in astrotourism at the moment, and not a great deal of people offer these services, particularly from the cultural aspect, which is important. And we are very fortunate, say, here in Hoedspruit, as I said, we've got dark skies, we've got locations close by. And it's important that we try and look after that and nurture it. I know we all want to see at night time, but we haven't really got time to get into light pollution. But I implore people out there, if you've got outside lights, great, but they don't need to be pointing up at the sky. Exactly. They don't need to be a million lumens, you know, have downward pointing lights. It's great for the sky. It has a knock-on effect on our circadian rhythms of the movements and migrations of animals. Just look at the number of insects that are attracted to a light. So try and use orange lights as opposed to
the bright
white, blue lights.
Soft lights.
Yeah, and the same goes for the municipality here as well. Street lamps, if we can have them sheltered downwards, not wasting light up into the sky, it makes makes a huge difference. And there are a lot of things that we as civilians or residents here can do, little things to improve.
Well, thank you so much. It was absolutely wonderful.
I'd just like to ask quite a lot more specifically, because I know that the subject has huge appeal and interest, universal interest in a place like this. So your business, would you do sort of small groups? If they contacted you to book, so a group of friends?
Yes, it's not just lodge stuff. So pretty much I have four arms, if you like, of the business, but I'm happy to do anything that people want because I enjoy sharing the knowledge. But the night sky safaris I go to lodges, guest houses. I have a location that we can use where people can come to me as well, so it doesn't have to be lodge people that I do events for. If there are local people that are interested to learn more, we do the standard laser pointer cultural tour. We use the telescopes, the visual and the photographic telescopes. So that's available literally to anybody, and you don't have to have any prior knowledge. I'll tailor it according to your interests. Obviously, the guide training I do is more for the industry, for the guiding industry. I can also do astrophotography tuition and evenings and post-processing workshops, because that's a big part of astrophotography. You've got to tease out those finer details. And then even for people overseas, I can offer what I call virtual stargazing. So remember, in the Northern Hemisphere, they are not privy to a lot of the areas of sky here. I don't want to upset anybody, but on the basis the Earth is round, you can't see the Southern Hemisphere sky from the Northern Hemisphere.
If this is a flat Earther, you're not even having this conversation.
I refuse to get involved in that debate. Exactly. But I've done a few evenings for clients and schools and astronomy clubs in the Northern Hemisphere, so in the Americas, in Europe. And with the photographic telescope, I can stream those live images of objects like the Jewel Box, Omega Centauri, and the Magellanic Clouds, and we can discuss them and give them a chance to see it.
So, and how can we get hold of you?
Well, I have a website. It's www.celestialeventssa.com. Email is celestialeventssa@gmail.com. And obviously our social media as well. I've got Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, the contact details are on the website. I went to it yesterday.
Perfect.
So, but Ben, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
We're going to try and organise something. The paddle guys are super, super keen, as is Nature on Tap, to do something with you guys. So no doubt there will be an event at the paddle complex in the coming days and weeks, hopefully.
Come up with an interesting topic. So there's so many, the hardest part is deciding
which
what.
One.
Sure.
But I'll probably focus on something more on the cultural aspect. But awesome. we'll put in a bit, and questions can lead us anywhere.
Of course.
Indeed.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in studio. It's been absolutely wonderful to have you, and we look forward to being with you again and enjoying one of your talks.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be here. Thanks to everybody listening. And I look forward to doing something in the near future with the guys at Paddle and anything else. But thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you. And that was Ben Coley here in studio. Fantastic chat.